WEFZ。
Programming at WEFT is brought to you in part by Minuteman Press. Whether you need signs for an event, thousands of full-color flyers, or personalized promotional items, Minuteman Press can make it happen in time and on budget. They offer an extensive line of products as well as design services. Minuteman Press may be reached online at cuprinting.com, in person at 905 South Neal Street in Champaign, or by calling 217-355-0500.
Good evening. You're listening to WEFT 90.1 FM radio. And of course, you can listen to us on our website on the Listen Live tab at weft.org. You can also listen to our number of other programs such as Radio Theater, which will be right after my show. This is the program Where Are We At? My name is Ben. The date is February 14th, 2022. Happy Valentine's Day. And now here is your weather forecast. Today, it was 29 degrees with a bit of sunshine. And tonight is going to be mainly clear. It'll get down to 15 degrees. Winds 5 to 10 miles per hour southeast. Tomorrow, Tuesday, your high will be 43 degrees. Partly cloudy. Chance of 16 mile per hour winds. Wednesday, the 16th, your high will be 53 degrees, cloudy, and some wind. The low will probably be about 31 degrees. Thursday, a very high likely chance of snow on Thursday, the 17th, 33 degrees, and it can get down to single digits that probably late evening Thursday. Hey, I'm sorry. I'm just, with what I have in front of me, I'm just reading it out to you all. So I do apologize about that. But Friday, it will be sunny, but still cold. 28 degrees, your high with 15 mile per hour winds. And Thursday, there'll be 23 mile per hour winds along with that snow. Again, yeah, it's going to be, we're still in winter, folks. Still in winter. So be careful out there on the roads. And if you can, try to stay inside. If possible, and stay warm. A reminder that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates.
And now for some public service announcements.
The CU at Home Men's Emergency Shelter is provided year-round, 365 days a year. Intakes begin at 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. Service provided at CU at Home at 70 East Washington Street in Champaign, which is the former Times Center location. Light snacks are available. Showers and laundry are available in emergency situations. You can contact Thomas Welt. The phone number is 217-819-4569. Again, the phone number, 217-819-4569. You could also call 217-649-2200. Again, that phone number, 217-649-2200. After business hours and need shelter, call the CU at Home Outreach Hotline. That phone number is 217-888-0329. And again, that last one, the CU at Home Outreach Hotline, phone number 217-888-0329. There is also Austin's Place, which is a shelter for women, which provides overnight emergency shelter for women year-round. Intakes begin at 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. This resource is housed at CU at Home's 70 East Washington Street facility in Champaign, which is the former Times Center building. Light snacks are provided. Showers and laundry are also available. For more information, you can contact Chloe Hansen. The phone number is 217-819-4569. Again, that phone number, 217
819-4569. They also have a website, See You at Home, which you can Google. It would probably just be possible to Google See You at Home, shelterAustin'sPlace.weebly.com. And after business hours is the same number, is the same phone number as before that I read a few minutes ago. See You at Home, outreach hotline, 217-888-0329. Again, that phone number is 217-888-0329. The Daily Bread Soup Kitchen's mission is to feed the hungry in our community. Currently, they provide a hot, nutritional meal in a biodegradable clamshell box plus a hearty sack lunch to go from 11 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. 7 days a week. Because of COVID-19, though, they cannot currently offer inside dining. The Daily Bread Soup Kitchen is located on 116 North 1st Street in Champaign. Their phone number is 217-356-7687. Their website is Daily Bread Soup Kitchen, all one word, dailybreadsoupkitchen.com. And again, they are located on 116 North 1st Street in Champaign, and they offer a free sack lunch to go from 11 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. 7 days a week. And we thank them for their hospitality and for the work that they have been doing. For rental assistance, you can go to the Champaign County Regional Planning Commission. If you would like, their website is ccrpc.org. And then when you get onto the website, you'll go to Programs and Services and then click on Emergency Rent Assistance. But yes, Champaign County Regional Planning Commission. Again, that website, ccrpc.org. Please consider supporting the programming you love. WFT will gladly accept that vehicle you've been looking to get rid of. Our vehicle donation program provides an effortless option to support WEFT Community Radio. You can give CARS, C-A-R-S, Charitable Adult Rides and Services, a call at 1-855-500-RIDE or fill out the secure donation form at CAREASY, CAREASY.org. Just remember to designate WEFT as the nonprofit beneficiary of your gift. WFT truly appreciates supporters like you. If you're wondering what is showing at the Virginia Theater in Champaign, you can look up updates that are posted as soon as they become available. For more information, go to the Virginia Theater website, the Virginia, all one word, thevirginia.org. thevirginia.org. You can also call their phone number, 217-356-9063. Again, that phone number is 217-356-9063. You can also email them at virginia@champaignparks.org. Just a reminder that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates.
You can pray until you faint, but if you don't get up and try to do something, God is not going to put it in your lap. And it's no need of running and no need of saying, honey, I'm not going to get in the mess. We'll be right back.
Welcome to Black Power Talks. I'm Dr. Matsumela Odom.
And I'm Dexter Mlemwengu. Uhuru means freedom in Swahili, and freedom is on our minds 24/7.
On January 24th, 2019, Chairman Omali Eshetela of the African People's Socialist Party presented at Oxford University in Oxford, England. This address was delivered to the Oxford Union on the same floor that Malcolm X had addressed the world 55 years before, known as the Africa Debate. Speakers addressed the prompt, does Africa need an even closer union, or is it better off looking to the wider world? In his talk, Chairman Omali Eshetela argued in the affirmative with an important caveat. This union needs to be grounded in the leadership and advanced theory of the African working class. That leadership is not found in the neo-colonial African Union, but instead in the African Socialist International. That advanced theory is African internationalism. Chairman Omali Eshetela took African internationalism to the center of bourgeois academia and won. Most importantly, he has won the masses of African people. Chairman Omali Eshetela's Africa Debate presentation has been viewed by tens of millions of African people. In August 2021, Talib Kweli shared a snippet of the speech on his Instagram page that has gained almost 50,000 views alone.
The reach of the Africa Debate reflects the five decades of political and theoretical influence of Chairman Omali Eshetela in African internationalism. Chairman Omali has published more than a dozen books and founded the Burning Spear newspaper, the oldest African revolutionary journal in continuous print. In recent years alone, his writings and other African internationalist works have been cited in dozens of books, articles, and theses. This war of ideas has played a significant role in the resurgence of anti-colonial publications that have emerged. With the military defeat of the Black Power movement, an assault was made against the colonial question by reactionary forces and liberal left ideological imperialists alike. They told Africans that our primary struggle was to reform the racist superstructure, not destroy the colonial capitalist base. Malcolm X was amongst the earliest of African leaders to propose that colonialism was a primary contradiction that Africans in the U.S. faced. The colonial question was placed into concrete political organization through the philosophy of African internationalism.
Universities function as a key part of the colonial capitalist superstructure. In universities, African people have been chopped up, literally, divided, and renamed in accordance to the general workings of colonial capitalism. The two largest divisions of this in universities are African studies and African American studies. In recent decades, there has been an internationalist and all-African turn in the literature of many African scholars, namely those in the field of Africana studies, the field that I work in. I can personally attest to what Dexter just described because I have been a part of this journey. The introduction of my doctoral thesis acknowledges the leadership of African internationalism and Chairman Omali Eshetela. And I have even been able to craft Africana studies curricula to teach African internationalism to my students. I first encountered African internationalism through hip hop music and the Burning Spear newspaper. After that, the multiple references to African internationalism, the African People's Socialist Party, and Chairman Omali Eshetela by the late Africana studies scholar and African working class intellectual Rob Bush helped to guide my own journey. The on-the-ground upsurge of the African working class during this moment has brought this internationalism into these studies to the forefront.
Today we speak with Professor Layla Brown about a scholarship, the COVID-19 pandemic, and the way forward. Professor Brown's work is emblematic of that anti-colonial turn, or might we say anti-colonial return, that has taken place in Africana studies. Professor Brown is trained as a cultural anthropologist, researcher, and educator. She earned her PhD from Duke University and specializes in the contemporary and historical study of social movements in the African diaspora. She places specific focus on African communities in the Americas, as well as African women liberation. She's an assistant professor of cultural anthropology and Africana studies at Northeastern University, but is currently a visiting professor in Germany. Professor Brown's recent research looks at the COVID-19 colonial virus pandemic, African resistance, and colonial domination. Her recent article, The Pandemic of Racial Capitalism, Another World is Possible, was published in From the European South. Uhuru, Professor Layla, how you doing?
I'm well. How are you all?
I'm well.
Glad to have you on the show.
So, Professor Brown, how would you like us to refer to you? Professor, doctor?
Please call me Layla.
Okay.
Dr. Brown is reserved for my students and white people who don't know better.
So, we're now 2 years into the pandemic with honestly no one in sight. When you first began the pandemic, if I'm correct, you were in South Africa as part of a fellowship program. How mm-hmm. was that experience for you?
Honestly, I'm so glad that that's where I was. At first, I was a writing fellow, and then I was a visiting research fellow at the Johannesburg Institute for Advanced Study. It's also where I was physically when I was able to write that Pandemic of Racial Capitalism piece. In a lot of ways, in a very practical way, I was really shielded from the initial kind of loneliness of the pandemic because there were about 10 of us living in a compound together. And so because of the laws around quarantining and stuff, we essentially constituted a family. And so we were able to have our own space, but also still able to be together. So I wasn't alone during that time, but it was also really fruitful in terms of my thinking, right? So to be able to, I had colleagues who have since become very close friends, one of whom is Dr. Olivia Rutaziwa, who's faculty at the London School of Economics. She's Rwandan by origin, but grew up in Belgium. Another is Dr. Amaha Senu, who is, he's a professor of criminology at Swansea University in the UK, but he's Ethiopian. And it was a really nice opportunity to be able to live and think and work with other people who were concerned about the lives and works of African peoples around the globe. And I think that that's not something that I get enough of in the U.S. Academy. And so it was a really good and productive time to think about Black African people in the world.
I appreciate that answer, Layla. I appreciate that. So during the pandemic, the South African government placed draconian laws into place that really targeted the African working class there.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us about those laws and how they impacted the African working class?
For sure. So there were two cases in particular. So South Africa was one of, I think, maybe five countries that instituted a ban on the sale and consumption of alcohol supposedly as a way of managing the pandemic. So the narrative is that alcoholism is a big problem in South Africa and that so many of the hospitals and clinics are overwhelmed by alcohol-related injuries, car accidents, issues with domestic violence. So the logic that that Cyril Ramaphosa, utilized publicly was to say that in order to free up space in the clinics for COVID patients, they would ban the sale of alcohol and cigarettes on top of that. Now, what we know about banning the sale of illicit items is that that does not stop people from using them. It only actually makes the right. use and procurement of those things more dangerous, more right. expensive. Right. And so just shortly, I think South Africa went into lockdown March 27th of 2020. And just shortly after that, there are two cases, one of which was in Cape Town and one of which was in the Alex Township, one of the biggest townships in Johannesburg. The two men's names were Collins Kosa and Petrus Miggles. They were, because the sale of alcohol was banned, they were essentially caught, whatever that means, in possession of alcohol, right? And so the other thing is that the law supposedly made illegal the sale of alcohol, not necessarily the possession and or consumption. But the South African National Defense Force took this upon themselves to essentially police all, use, consumption, possession of alcohol. And so these two men, I think in both cases, they were in possession of maybe a few beers and were both beaten to death by the South African National Defense Force or the police for being in possession of those beers, right? And meanwhile, in other more affluent parts of South Africa, there were some restaurants that were still under the table selling alcohol, right? And so we saw this one, it increased the victimization and violence and brutalization that poor people and poor Black African people in particular experience at the hands of police. But then on top of it, because we know that people continue to buy, the Black market soared. And so now you have people who are already relatively poor spending two, three, and four times what they would have spent on the price of beer and the price of liquor, right? So you have all of these other sort of auxiliary cases of violence that are facilitated by these new ridiculous laws that are banning the sale and consumption and possession of alcohol that are adversely targeting and overwhelmingly impacting the Black population in South Africa.
Uhuru. Yeah, thanks for that. Because, you know, these laws sound a lot like the anti-African laws that were put in place by the white nationalist apartheid regime. Mm-hmm. They really show us, I think, what neocolonialism looks like. Now, as African internationalists, we define neocolonialism in short as white power in blackface. So can you explain the neocolonial contradictions of the COVID policy that you saw enacted in South Africa? You know,
absolutely. In a lot of ways, you know, it's tied to what I, you know, already explained in terms of just yet another excuse to increase surveillance and the policing, because I think it was in the case of Collins Khosa in particular, this he was not out of his home. So I think it was actually Easter weekend. He was in his home on his own property. I think police were patrolling the neighborhoods and were walking by their home and saw a can of beer, and they actually entered into their home, not only beat him to death, beat his friend to death, beat his wife. And that even in the follow-up to that, very similar to the way we see in the U.S., initially the police were found to have done no wrong. Then because there was a lot of uproar about the cases, there was a case brought against them. But then ultimately, again, they were found to have done no wrong, right? And so we see these sort of same practices of surveillance and brutality in the U.S. and in South Africa. And as we know, the apartheid regime is one of the most famous for its specific forms of violence and brutality. And they were beat, you know, in that case, Collins Khosa and Peter Schmeichel were beaten to death with sjambocks, right? And then we all know sjambocks very well from apartheid era South Africa. And, you know, and then again, like I said, this idea that making any type of substance temporarily illegal for the sake of some other greater cause does not actually increase safety. And in fact, because of being locked down, the instances of femicide, the instances of domestic violence increased dramatically because people were out of work. And we do know that there are correlations between, you know, being stuck at home, feeling as if we are, you know, useless, having nowhere to go, no work to go to. Tensions rise in the homes, right? And so there are all kinds of secondary forms of violence that came out as a result of the imposition of the lockdown and the subsequent laws that they imposed in order to uphold the lockdown.
That's interesting. I really appreciate your analysis right there, especially the way through which you noted the colonial violence led to the increased incidence of horizontal violence within the African community over there in South Africa. Because I want to give a shout out to some of the comrades we got working on the ground in South Africa right now. Director Tafari McGarry, who I know avidly listens to the show, as well as comrade Zakele Mkondo and so many other comrades. I remember there was a moment in time in which the South African police had actually killed more people than COVID had killed at the beginning of the pandemic. So I really find this, you know, what you're saying here very interesting.
Not only that, but Cyril Ramaphosa, the president at the time, he was the leader of the mine workers union, but he was complicit in the deals that resulted in the massacre at Marikana, right? And so what would you call it? The faith or the support that South African people, particularly Black South African people, have in Ramaphosa himself in order to think about the greater good of people in the country was already waning. And then on top of that, you know, with the growth of the Economic Freedom Fighters, the EFF, and other forces on the ground, obviously the PAC has been active for a very long time, but the ANC's popularity, you know, is quickly waning for a number of reasons, least of which was Ramaphosa's complicity in the Marikana massacres and the way that, you know, the COVID pandemic has been handled in South Africa.
Thank you for that, Leila. Thank you. I unite. So for you, the Cuban and Venezuelan responses to the pandemic are examples that we should embrace. What has stood out to you about the Cuban and Venezuelan responses? And can you contrast that a little bit with the U.S.?
Sure. You know, Cuba has, you know, since the Cuban Revolution and remains famous for its medical diplomacy. One of the things that happened very early on in the pandemic, within the first month, I remember there was a cruise ship that was out in Caribbean waters that no one would allow to dock because of the number of COVID cases that were active on the cruise ship. And Cuba, in spite of the blockade, in spite of the, you know, limited resources that the country has because of the decades long embargo and blockade, allowed the cruise ship to dock. Because of its advanced medical technology and its, you know, commitment to educating its population, they were able to manage and maintain the outbreak on the ship and were able to get people home safely. But one of the other things that Cuba recognized very early on was because of the embargo and because of the way that global capitalism operates, you know, this rush to create vaccines was not going to reach the so-called developing world at the same rate. And so one of the first things the Cuban state did was move to develop their own vaccines. And it's interesting because very early on in the development of the vaccine, Cuba had so few active COVID cases that they were unable to test the efficacy of the vaccine because they didn't have enough sick people in the country. And so they had to outsource testing of the vaccines to countries that they have better diplomatic relationships with, like Iran. But at the current moment, you know, here we are almost 2 years into the pandemic. Cuba has developed two successful vaccines, and more than 90% of Cuba's population is vaccinated. And what's important about that is that there is no forced vaccination in Cuba. So 90% of the population in Cuba is voluntarily vaccinated. And, you know, you can look at that in comparison to what has happened in the rest of the world and the toll that is the U.S. In the case of Venezuela, there were some very early cases. Like, there was a 6-month moratorium on rents that was later extended. There was a 6-month imposition where the government disallowed anyone to be fired or to lose their job. They could not be evicted from their homes. The clap boxes, which would be akin to kind of food stamp support in the U.S., was extended to the majority of the population, right? And so there were, you know, very real measures put in place very early on in the case of Venezuela to make it possible for people to lock down, right? So, you know, when people start thinking about, do I stay home or do I keep my job? And keep my job is about, do I continue to be able to feed myself and clothe myself and house myself? The Venezuelan government took that question away from the people, right? They said, we want you to stay home. We know that because of the embargo that's imposed on Venezuela, we don't necessarily have the resources to deal with a major outbreak. So we need to do our best to contain this as early as possible. And how we do that is by incentivizing people to stay home. And what we do in order to do that is to let people know you will not be homeless, you will not go hungry, and you will not lose your jobs by staying home, right? And so this, you know, for me, what I saw in the difference between that and what happened in the U.S. and even in the case of South Africa was that there was a value that was placed on life, right? As opposed to, you know, the ways that neoliberal capitalism continues to place us in jeopardy and requires us to choose being able to make money over our health and safety. And what I saw in the case of Venezuela and Cuba is that they just eliminated that choice very early on in the pandemic.
Ooh, thank you. Yeah, and I really appreciate that answer. And I mean, I think just like you said, you know, just the difference between the Venezuelan and the Cuban response versus the U.S. I mean, that's a clear distinction between a government who's prioritizing the health and welfare of the people, and one that is not. And just the fact that, you know, these vaccines aren't, you know, people aren't being coerced to take these vaccines, and that shows that these people genuinely trust on the government to have their best interests at heart. So, you know, just I really appreciate that emphasis you made. You are listening to Black Power Talks, produced by WBPU, Black Power 96.3 FM in St. Petersburg, Florida. Today we are discussing the anti-colonial turn of Africana studies, the COVID-19 pandemic, and popular culture with Professor Leila Brown.
All right, Uhuru. So, Layla, you recently listened to our show on the role of African intellectuals in the world. What were your thoughts?
I mean, you know, this is something that I appreciate you all for having that conversation. And it's something that I think a lot and have thought a lot about for a long time, because I think, you know, the way that we as people who are, you know, consider ourselves to be concerned with African liberation, you know, we have different contributions to make, and, you know, everybody has different roles to play, and they're all important. But the role of the intelligentsia is an interesting one, right? Because it is both important and also very susceptible to treachery, right? And so, you know, one of the things that I have always been concerned about is making sure that I continue to do work that benefits the people who I say I want it to benefit, and that comes from the people who I say I want the work to benefit. And so, you know, I often think about the admonitions of both Kwame Ture and Kwame Nkrumah when they, you know, they talk about, you know, what our role and our responsibility is, and that one of the main ones is to not fall victim to the sort of petty bourgeois trappings of what intellectual life, particularly in the U.S. Academy, can do, because it can make it really easy to lose your commitment to what you are supposed to be doing, right? And so for us, you know, those of us who consider ourselves, you know, revolutionaries, people who want to bring about socialism, identify as a Pan-Africanist, the work that we're supposed to do is to facilitate that process of liberation. And so we're always supposed to be observing, documenting the world as we see it, but we're also supposed to be thinking about, you know, what are the, I don't even want to refer to them as mistakes, but what are the cases that we can learn from? Where are the places that we don't need to reinvent the wheel? And where are the places where we perhaps need to reevaluate? And that's really supposed to be our role. Our role is not to, as the U.S. Academy would have us, publish books and create a cushy lifestyle. And that's very, very much an easy thing to do. And, you know, I'm not necessarily known people who make that choice. But if you consider yourself to be, you know, a revolutionary, your role and your responsibility is to always be thinking about, writing about, contemplating revolution. And that's why I will say this. I don't know if you all, you know, want to keep this in or not, but that's one of my issues with the recent obsession with Afro-pessimism in the U.S. Academy. One of the things that Afro-pessimists like to claim.
Speak on it.
Here's my issue. I mean, the one of the primary proponents of it is he's a performance studies scholar, right? And so what I will say is that his writing is very interesting and intriguing, and it's dramatic and it's entertaining. And so, like, you know, when my students come to me and they are intrigued by it and it speaks to them, you know, I tell them, like, it makes sense that it speaks to you because it's easy to read, but it's problematically nihilistic in a lot of ways. And I think that what I find problematic about Afro-pessimism is their constant claim that it is not prescriptive. And that is not the work that we do as African Black revolutionary scholars. We have a responsibility to do prescriptive work, right? And that doesn't mean that we know exactly what to do, but we have a responsibility to be trying to think our way out of our current predicament. It is not only our responsibility to describe. And even the notion within Afro-pessimism as a field that, you know, we got to blow up the world. Afro-pessimism is not the only field of thought that thinks about the fact that we need to blow up this shit and that's what a theory of revolution is. A theory of revolution is change, and that in order to have profound change, you got to get rid of the sort of profound foundations that are already in existence, right? And so I just like to remind my students that there are other schools of thought that allow us to think about getting rid of everything as it is and allow us to think about creating something anew. For me, that's Pan-Africanism, right? For me, you know, as a member of the All African People's Revolutionary Party, GC, our objective, so what we understand Pan-Africanism is as a political objective, which is the total liberation and unification of Africa under scientific socialism. And we also understand that that objective not only benefits people on the African continent, but it benefits those of us in the African diaspora. And that for us, Africa is primary, right? As opposed to you know, the way I see Afro-pessimism as a field of thought is very U.S.-centric. And that's, you know, another place where I have a big issue with it as a field of study. And so for me, you know, I constantly take, you know, that I'm constantly trying to think about the work that I'm supposed to be doing in order to envision a better world for us and our people.
So Layla, there's been a significant internationalist turn in Africana studies, the discipline that you and Masemela both teach in. As well, there's been a concurrent resurgence of internationalism and all African solidarity. You write about some of this African unity in your work, namely linking the struggles in the U.S. to Venezuela. Can you tell us a little about that?
Sure. I mean, let's see. I'm going to take it back even more than that. So I am a graduate of North Carolina Central University. I'm from Raleigh, North Carolina, and I spent 13 years in Durham between NCCU and undergrad and Duke in grad school. And one of the things that struck me very early on, so I was a Spanish and history double major in undergrad, and I had this professor, Afro-Mexican professor, his name is Marco Polo Hernandez Cuevas. He has actually now since relocated to Venezuela permanently. But I remember when I was an undergrad, he used to bring Chucho Garcia to campus a lot. And at the time, like, I didn't really know the significance of, you know, who he was and what was happening. But I remember when I started contemplating going to grad school, because my parents are members of the AAPRPGC, I grew up spending a lot of time. My father has been to every African Liberation Day that has happened in the United States in D.C. since 1972, I believe. 72, 73 was the first year. And so, you know, I spent a lot of time in D.C. And I remember in about 2008, I was trying to think about what I was going to do my dissertation research on. And I was at Howard and I stumbled on this conference, What's Up with Venezuela Now? And I remember walking into the Blackburn Center and there were all these Afro-Venezuelan people talking about the Bolivarian Revolution and what and how Hugo Chavez had changed the sort of material conditions of Afro-Venezuelans, you know, in their lifetime, right? And I remember people saying things like, when I started going to Venezuela, people saying things like, before Chavez, like, politics was a thing that politicians did. Like, we as everyday Venezuelans didn't think about politics in that way. But one of the things that I really appreciated about what happened with the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela, so I didn't mention this, but the first time I went to Venezuela was in 2011. And we know Chavez passed a couple years later. But when Chavez first came to power in 98, the Bolivarian Revolution was definitely a populist movement. It was left of center, but not socialist per se. And it was after the 2002 coup, when Chavez was ousted, that he recognized who his base was. And that his base was primarily the African indigenous peoples of Venezuela, and it was largely women. And, you know, at that point, you know, he started really thinking about, okay, what does it mean to build a socialist, you know, revolution, what he called 21st century socialism? But what does it mean to do that and not replicate some of the same mistakes that the Cuban Revolution did, right? Because in the case of Cuba, while the revolution meant it immediately changed the material conditions of people of African descent, largely the conversations around race were not central, not even allowed early on in the case of the Cuban Revolution. And this is something that, you know, Fidel Castro later even, you know, he takes responsibility for, and he says, you know, we didn't necessarily make all the right decisions about that. And one of the reasons, ways that we see that is that in 98, when the Soviet Union falls and Cuba no longer has the financial backing that it did before, those same types of racial tensions that existed pre-revolution start to resurge, because the attitudes and the notions about, you know, racial disparities weren't necessarily dispelled. The material conditions disallowed it, but once the material conditions changed, then those attitudes resurfaced. And so what I saw in the case of Venezuela, and even Chavez, even under Castro's mentorship, was that, you know, as they were pushing the Bolivarian Revolution to the left, they needed to take these questions about race and gender more seriously. You know, and I've been traveling back and forth to Venezuela off and on since 2011. My most recent trip to Venezuela was actually last year in July for the Peoples of the Americas conference. And one of the things that I was really impressed by was that there is an ongoing thread. And then the year before, I went to a conference in Caracas as well. But there is an ongoing conversation about the particular role of people of African descent in building socialist movements, people on the left, right? And so not exclusively these questions about culture or, you know, some of the more superficial ways that we think about race and politics, but in particular, what does it mean for people of African descent to be thinking about building socialism in the world? And obviously, Venezuela is not only thinking about this in relationship to people of African descent, but they're also indigenous populations, also in all kinds of other forms of configurations. But one of the things that I have observed and that I will argue is that I think in the case of Venezuela and Cuba, what we see is that in countries where they are attempting to build socialism, people of African descent overwhelmingly fare better, right? And so so for me, it's just yet another testament to the anti-Black, anti-African nature of capitalism, of you know, this sort of extractive practices of capitalism and these forms of accumulation that just they will not result in a better way of life for us, and that we have to continue to look, as imperfect as they are, to the examples where people are attempting to at least experiment with what socialism means and what it means to think about that in relationship to these, you know, very old questions about anti-Black, anti-African racism.
Thanks for that. Now, we've talked about this a little bit already in this show about the significance of the anti-colonial term in the broader field of Africana studies that you and I are a part of. Why is this turn important, and why is it important that we remember this turn as linked to the African Revolution of the 1960s and not some of these more, you know, petty bourgeois intellectual, you know, poet things? I mean, one of the things you point out here is that the connections with Venezuela amongst African people are grounded in politics, right? In overturning the colonial capitalist base of which we have, labored against for, you know, 600 years. It's not simply, you know, the connections between reggae music and cumbia or something like that, which surely is there and is interesting, right? But at the center of your argument was one about politics and one about, you know, revolution and remaking the world that way. Because honestly, some of that other stuff, and it's really just without this, that argument, for me, just becomes, you know, reformist. You know, how can we survive as better colonial subjects, you know? And I mean, you see it. I mean, I don't want to rant too much, but you see it. You know, you know there'll be books about how enslaved Africans made dresses as a retreat from slavery. Like, making a dress gonna free you from slavery. You know, and you know what I'm talking about. And it's generally white liberal scholars, but many of the African scholars have been trained from the same perspective.
It's true. I mean, you know, I will also say that was something I also appreciated very early on about, you know, you all have already mentioned I'm trained as an anthropologist, right? And anthropology is the handmaiden of colonialism. We all know that. Although all of these disciplines, you know, have played their role in maintaining it. But, you know, back to the question that you asked, the connection to making sure we understand what this turn or this return, as you have phrased it, to a particular kind of anti-colonial, anti-imperial politics is what from my understanding, where the discipline comes from, right? Where the necessity of studying Black freedom struggles in the it was focused in the U.S. but comes from it comes out of this particular moment in the 50s and 60s in the U.S. where people were also looking internationally, right? I mean, you know, Kwame Nkrumah came famously, he was at Lincoln University. He conscientism would not be his sort of philosophical opus without his time that he spent in the U.S. studying as a student and being able to link these struggles. And I would be remiss to even mention that it wouldn't even be that without his mentorship of Kwame Ture later on, and the kind of struggles and battles they had over thinking about the connections between people on the continent and people in the diaspora. So, I mean, that's a very important it's not even a connection to make. It's a truth to remember, right? And I think that that even goes back to your earlier question about what our role, what is the role and the responsibility of African intellectuals, is to remember that these connections and the service and the duty that we're supposed to be providing, and that we don't do this shit on our own. I mean, one of the things I'm always appreciative about is that because I went to grad school where I grew up, I remained grounded in the communities where I came from. And so there was never this moment where there was a disconnect between what I was working on and who I was accountable to. And that people who I worked with were very invested in my quote unquote success through doctoral studies. But it wasn't just about them being able to say, oh, Layla will have a PhD. It was about what I'm supposed to be able to do with this. You know, and to your point about the sort of cultural studies, this is the point I was going to make earlier about anthropology. One of the things that I noticed very early on when I went to Venezuela is that one of the reasons why the Afro-Venezuelan population is so adamant about having a conversation about their role in the politics of the state is that so much of what has been written, codified in culture, in the context of the country in general, is that Black people provide culture, right? They provide fun, they provide all these other things to the nation state, but they are not a part of the specific political, historical trajectory of the country. And that's a fight that they are constantly waging, that we contribute more than tambores and arroz, right? Like we have more to contribute than drums and food and music and whatever. And all that's good and fine, right? Like it's part of who we are. It's how we, you know, we have the freedom to do that and exist as full and realized human beings. But there's also more to our lives than that, and that we have something to contribute beyond the sort of ways that people want to take advantage of our cultural production.
Uhuru. Yeah, thanks for that. And, you know, you actually talked about something that I had hoped to talk about a little bit later, but I just want to just note that, much like you, I went to school for my doctoral studies within the community and maintained constant connections to the community of which I emerged out of, you know, as a young African working class intellectual. In that, I really felt a drive to make sure that I was completing really relevant political projects as a part of my studies, so that I can help to answer some of the questions that are really needed for the advancement of the African nation, for the advancement of African liberation. And yeah, so I just really want to unite with really, really that sort of urgency that even informed and continues to inform your own research, because, you know, it really shows. It really shows. So I really want to just salute your work, really, as an African working class intellectual scholar.
I appreciate that.
You are listening to Black Power Talks, produced by WBPU, Black Power 96.3 FM in St. Petersburg, Florida. Today we are discussing the anti-colonial turn of Africana studies, the COVID-19 pandemic, and popular culture, Professor Layla Brown. So Layla, Chairman Amale Chatella of the African People's Socialist Party has defined this moment of imperialist crisis as the uneasy equilibrium. For 600 years, African people have served as a pedestal for the material wealth and advancement of Europe and the white world. As we rise up, things become shaky for them. That is the basis of their own crisis. January 6th represented that. In his book titled The Uneasy Equilibrium, Chairman Amale Chatella notes that the superstructure of colonial capitalism reflects this crisis. There are a resurgent number of films about superheroes from the past. These films represent a nostalgia for earlier periods of colonial capitalism. Meanwhile, dystopian and apocalyptic films and TV shows have increasingly reflected our present. So I know you're interested in these sort of films. So let's ask you, how do you see popular culture reflecting a yearn for the heyday of colonial capitalism?
I do not by any means want to conflate what I truly understand socialism to be with Bernie Sanders. But I think it is important to think about the fact that prior to Bernie Sanders' candidacy, you know, it was not a word that was that was really popular in the American lexicon, right? Like people, it's not a phrase that people use now through all his misunderstandings and whatever. It has entered into the lexicon, right? And so there's more and more conversation. I think, you know, younger people in the U.S. in particular, all over the world, but in the U.S. in particular, are seeing that, like, the promise is bull. Like, meritocracy is a lie. Like, this, it ain't got to do with how hard you work. It, none of this stuff, right? And so I think that there is an openness. And I think we even see that on the African continent, right? Like in the case, like right now, you know, there are great wages in Burkina Faso, in Mali, in Guinea, right? We, you know, we constantly see these sort of uprisings where people are, you know, people are fed up. And I think that that is reflected in some elements of popular culture. I think that, you know, that's part of the reason why Squid Games, I can't even talk. That is part of the reason why Squid Games was popular. You know, however you want to evaluate it, it is a critique of what it means to do anything for money and to sacrifice our humanity for money. And so I do think that, you know, I tend to like zombie apocalyptic type films and vampires. But I think one of the reasons why I like them, vampires in a lot of ways have been for a long time, zombies and vampires have in a lot of ways for a long time been associated with like this notion of walking dead, right? The notion of being alive but not really living and just sort of being a leech in certain types of ways. But that I think that they contemplate what the general human condition, right? I don't necessarily think that all these films are thinking particularly about the African predicament in this, but they are thinking about the human condition and what will we sort of devolve or perhaps evolve into when the trappings of capitalism, right? When these ways that we currently exist are cease to be options. And I do think that we see a counter to that in the kind of superhero genre where people are like, you know, they're trying to take us back to 1940s, which is a weird time to want to take us back to. But they want to take us back to these moments to celebrate, you know, American, I don't know, greatness. And I think obviously that's a preoccupation that white Americans have with no longer being great, whatever that means to them. But I do appreciate the tensions that are currently arising in popular culture that are trying to get people to at least ask some questions about, is this the only way that we can exist?
Uhuru. Yeah, thanks for that. Because, you know, one thing that I've actually noticed is that in this return towards trying to remember a moment when the U.S. was quote unquote great, for whatever that means, like you note, that the colonial capitalist superstructure, right, Hollywood, has begun to make place for Africans in that. Mm. You know, I got a lot of pushback for me not really liking that film, The Harder They Fall, or something like that. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, it took the name from The Harder They Come. The Harder They Come was clearly an anti-colonial film. And it was clearly a critique of, you know, the Western genre, in sense of which these films have been dumped into Jamaica, the Caribbean, and other African communities, really to reinforce the dominant ideology coming out of the U.S. And you see that in the film. But, I mean, in this film, basically, you just get the fact that just, you know, you get to imagine the West and all its treachery as also African. And so I think that's also part of the culture that's being produced by colonial capitalism as well as other things, which, you know, some people might not like this critique, but the emergence of the Black Panther, right? But in this sense, the Black Panther, you know, is using his skills to help defend, you know, the biggest imperialist country on the face of the earth.
Collaborate with the CIA and hide.
Yeah, right. Right. So, and this ain't no diss. I mean, we, you know, rest in peace to the brother. He's an excellent, excellent actor. And, mm-hmm. and I mean, you know, I mean, Idris was in that other movie and everybody loved Idris.
I'm an Idris lover.
I love Chadwick. I love Idris. You know, they all got the race of who gonna be the next Denzel, right? But they walk like him and everything. So So it's not to diss them, but it is to raise the colonial capitalist contradictions.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Yeah.
I will say this though. That is one thing that I do appreciate about what pop culture does. I think we talked about this on our show recently because we did a shoot on No More Holidayification, and we were talking about the idea about these sort of monuments and days where we celebrate, you know, big figures. But, you know, for all of its faults, you know, films like Blood Diamond or Amistad, or, you know, whatever they are, they have their problems and critiques. But I do think that what they do, and I think they continue to do, is introduce these important moments back into popular culture for a new generation to begin to ask questions about. And the responsibility, again, back to your question about what our role is as African intellectuals, is to be ready. It's to be ready to field those questions and point people in other directions that gives them more and better. Right. So we take advantage of these kind of pop culture upswings and surges to then actually build momentum. Right. And so I think that that's what an organizer's responsibility is that we have to always be prepared, even in the lulls when people aren't thinking about things, so that when momentum builds up and when people are ready to move, we are able to harness that, right? That's our responsibility. So we don't have the luxury of not thinking about these things ever. We are not all there is. We ain't gonna be able to do shit by ourselves, but if we remain committed and dedicated to this work, then when the masses of people are ready to move, we have some people who have been thinking about these things in the in-between times who can help us move in a better direction.
Uhuru, yeah, thanks for that. I completely unite.
So Leila, we really appreciate you having on the show. We just want to ask you at this point, you know, what new research do you have on the horizon? You know, what do you have going on right now? I understand you have a podcast.
Yeah, so I am a co-host, but I guess I would say one third of the team for the Last Open Intellectual podcast, which, you know, we do have visuals. So we can be found on YouTube, but we can also be found on any other audio platform, streaming platform. But Sharice and I, the co-hosts, we are actually going to be doing a conversation series that Monthly Review Press asked us to do recently, where we read classic texts by African authors, right? So we're starting with Conscientism by Nkrumah. We're going on to Walter Rodney. We're going to read Cabral. I think it was those three in conversation with some other folks. So those things are coming up. In terms of my own research, so I'm working on my book project, which was largely based on my dissertation research that, you know, hopefully will be coming out in the next couple of years. But right now I'm actually working on an article. There's this handbook of global politics in the 22nd century, which is actually a really interesting project. They have asked us to write about right from the year 2120. And in particular, I was asked to think about this from a Pan-Africanist perspective. And so to think about a different kind of political lens on Afrofuturism, right? Not so much the sort of science, technology, pop culture view, but to think about, you know, for me, I'm thinking about what would the world look like had Nkrumah and Sekou Touré and, you know, Samora Michelle and Cabral's vision of a United States of Africa happened.
A reminder that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, Prayer Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. And that concludes this programming of Where We Are At here on WEFT 90.1 FM radio, and of course you can listen to us online at weft.org. Thank you so much for listening. Please stay tuned for more programming here on WEFT, and have a good night.
And I always like to let you know that if your organization has an upcoming fundraiser or wish to provide a service to the community, and be it a music or art event, workshop, or educational seminar, simply send a short script to WEFT at psa@weft.org, and we'll be sure to include it in our on-air public service announcements. You can also drop a flyer.